More on, the detox symptoms wore off, and I began to forget about my phone, she explained. A young management consultant named Daria admitted that during the first days of the experiment, she would compulsively pull out her phone before realizing she had removed all of the social media and news apps. The only thing left on her phone that she could check for new information was the weather. In that first week, she told me, I knew the hourly weather conditions in 3 to 4 different cities. The compulsion to browse something was too strong to ignore. After 2 weeks, however, she reported, I lost almost any interest in checking things online. This detox experience is important because it will help you make smarter decisions at the end of the declutter when you reintroduce some of these optional technologies to your life. A major reason that I recommend taking an extended break before trying to transform your digital life is that without the clarity provided by detox, the addictive pull of the technologies will bias your decisions. If you decide to reform your relationship with Instagram right this moment, your decisions about what role it should play in your life will likely be much weaker than if you instead spend 30 days without the service before making these choices. As I mentioned earlier in this chapter, however, it's a mistake to think of the digital declutter as only a detox experience. The goal is not to simply give yourself a break from technology, but to instead spark a permanent transformation of your digital life. The detoxing is merely a step that supports this transformation. With this in mind, you have duties during the declutter beyond following your technology rules. For this process to succeed, you must also spend this period trying to rediscover what's important to you and what you enjoy outside the world of the always-on, shiny digital. Figuring this out before you begin reintroducing technology at the end of this declutter process is crucial. An argument I'll elaborate on in part 2 of this book is that you're more likely to succeed in reducing the role of digital tools in your life if you cultivate high-quality alternatives to the easy distraction they provide. For many people, their compulsive phone use papers over a void created by a lack of a well-developed leisure life. Reducing the easy distraction without also filling the void can make life unpleasantly stale, an outcome likely to undermine any transition to minimalism. Another reason it's important to spend the 30 days of the declutter rediscovering what you enjoy is that this information will guide you during the reintroduction of technology at the end of the process. As stated, the goal of the reintroduction is to put technology to work on behalf of specific things you value. This means-to-an-end approach to technology requires clarity on what these ends actually are. The good news is that the participants in my mass declutter experiment found it easier than expected to reconnect to the types of activities they used to enjoy before they were subverted by their screens. A graduate student named Uneza was spending her evenings browsing Reddit. During her declutter, she redirected this time toward reading books that she borrowed from both her school and local library. I finished 8.5 books that month, she told me. I could never have thought about doing that before. An insurance agent named Melissa finished only 3 books during her 30 days, but also organized her wardrobe, set up dinners with friends, and scheduled more face-to-face conversations with her brother. I wish he was participating in a declutter experiment too, she told me, because he annoyingly watched his phone the whole time we were talking. She even kicked off a hunt for a new home that she had been delaying due to a perceived lack of time. By the end of the declutter, she had made an offer on a house, which was accepted. Kushboo finished 5 books during his declutter. This was a big deal for him, as these were the first books he had read voluntarily in over 3 years. He also restarted his once cherished painting and computer coding hobbies. I loved these activities, he explained, but I stopped doing them once I started school, because I thought I didn't have enough time. Caleb's search for intentional analog activities led him to start journaling and reading before bed every night. He also started listening to records on a record player from beginning to end, with no earbuds in his ears or skip buttons to tap when antsy, which turns out to be a much richer experience than Caleb's normal habit of firing up Spotify and seeking out the perfect track. A full-time mom named Mariana became so engaged in creative pursuits during her declutter that she decided she would start her own blog to share her work and connect with other artists. An engineer named Craig reported, "Last week, I actually visited my local library again for the first time since my kids have grown. I was delighted to discover 7 different books that seemed interesting." Like several other parents who participated in my experiment, Tarald invested his newfound time and attention in his family. He was unhappy with how distracted he was when spending time with his sons. He told me about how, on the playground, when they would come seeking recognition for something they figured out and were proud of, he wouldn't notice, as his attention was on his phone. I started thinking about how many of these small victories I miss out on because I feel this ridiculous need to check the news for the umpteenth time, he told me. During his declutter, he rediscovered the satisfaction of spending real time with his boys instead of just spending time near them with his eyes on the screen. He noted how surreal it can feel to be the only parent at the playground who is not looking down. Brooke also found herself interacting more intentionally with her kids. For her, this change wasn't engineered, but was instead a natural side effect of the declutter, which made her life feel far less rushed and distracted, leaving room to gravitate toward more important pursuits. She also ended up playing the piano again and relearning how to sew, underscoring the sheer quantity of the time that can be reclaimed when you sidestep mindless digital activity to once again prioritize the real you. Brooke captures well the experience many reported about their month-long declutter when she told me, "Stepping away for 31 days provided clarity I didn't know I was missing. As I stand here now from the outside looking in, I see there is so much more the world has to offer." To summarize the main points about this step, you will probably find the first week or two of your digital declutter to be difficult and fight urges to check technologies you're not allowed to check. These feelings, however, will pass, and this resulting sense of detox will prove useful when it comes time to make clear decisions at the end of the declutter. The goal of a digital declutter, however, is not simply to enjoy time away from intrusive technology. During this month-long process, you must aggressively explore higher quality activities to fill in the time left vacant by the optional technologies you're avoiding. This period should be one of strenuous activity and experimentation. You want to arrive at the end of the declutter having rediscovered the type of activities that generate real satisfaction, enabling you to confidently craft a better life, one in which technology serves only a supporting role for more meaningful ends. Step number 3. Reintroduce technology. After your 30-day break comes the final step of the digital declutter, reintroducing optional technologies back into your life. This reintroduction is more demanding than you might imagine. Some of the participants in my mass declutter experiment treated the process only as a classical digital detox, reintroducing all their optional technologies when the declutter ended. This is a mistake. The goal of this final step is to start from a blank slate and only let back into your life technology that passes your strict minimalist standards. It's the care you take here that will determine whether this process sparks lasting change in your life. With this in mind, for each optional technology that you're considering reintroducing into your life, you must first ask, does this technology directly support something that I deeply value? This is the only condition on which you should let one of these tools into your life. The fact that it offers some value is irrelevant. The digital minimalist deploys technology to serve the things they find most important in their life and is happy missing out on everything else. For example, when asking this first question, you might decide that browsing Twitter in search of distraction doesn't support an important value. On the other hand, keeping up with your cousin's baby photos on Instagram does seem to support the importance you place on family. Once a technology passes this first screening question, it must then face a more difficult standard. Is this technology the best way to support this value? We justify many of the technologies that tyrannize our time and attention with some tangential connection to something we care about. The minimalist, by contrast, measures the value of these connections and is unimpressed by all but the most robust. Consider our previous example about following your cousin's baby pictures on Instagram. We noted that this activity might be tentatively justified by the fact that you deeply value family. But the relevant follow-up question is whether browsing Instagram photos is the best way to support this value. On some reflection, the answer is probably no. Something as simple as actually calling this cousin once a month or so would probably prove significantly more effective in maintaining this bond. If a technology makes it through both of these screening questions, there's one last question you must ask yourself before it's allowed back into your life. How am I going to use this technology going forward to maximize its value and minimize its harms? A point I explore in part two is that many attention economy companies want you to think about their services in a binary way. Either you use it or you don't. This allows them to entice you into their ecosystem with some feature you find important, and then, once you're a user, deploy attention engineering to overwhelm you with integrated options, trying to keep you engaging with their service well beyond your original purpose. Digital minimalists combat this by maintaining standard operating procedures that dictate when and how they use the digital tools in their lives. They would never simply say, "I use Facebook because it helps my social life." They would instead declare something more specific, such as, "I check Facebook each Saturday on my computer to see what my close friends and family are up to. I don't have the app on my phone. I culled my list of friends down to just meaningful relationships." Pulling together these pieces, here's a summary of this minimalist screening process. The minimalist technology screen. To allow an optional technology back into your life at the end of the digital declutter, it must 1. Serve something you deeply value. Offering some benefit is not enough. 2. Be the best way to use technology to serve this value. If it's not, replace it with something better. 3. Have a role in your life that is constrained with a standard operating procedure that specifies when and how you use it. You can apply this screen to any new technology that you're considering adopting. When you deploy it at the end of a digital declutter, however, it becomes particularly effective, as the preceding break from these technologies provides you with clarity on your values and confidence that your life doesn't actually require that you slavishly stick with the digital status quo. If you're like many of the participants in my mass declutter experiment, the role of technology in your life will look quite different after navigating the reintroduction step with the aforementioned screening process. An electrical engineer named D, for example, was surprised to discover during his digital declutter how addicted he had become to checking news online and how anxious it was making him, especially politically charged articles. "I dumped all news during my declutter and loved it," he told me. "Ignorance is truly bliss sometimes." When the declutter concluded, he recognized that a complete news blackout was not sustainable, but also recognized that subscribing to dozens of email newsletters and compulsively checking breaking news sites was not the best way to satisfy his need to be informed. He now checks AllSides.com once a day, a news site that covers the top stories, but for each story, it neutrally links to 3 articles, one from a source associated with the political left, one from the right, and one from the center. This format has a way of diffusing the aura of emotional charge that permeates a lot of our current political coverage, allowing D to stay up to speed without the spike in anxiety. Kate solved this same problem by replacing reading news with listening to a News Roundup podcast each morning, keeping her informed without providing her the opportunity to mindlessly browse. Mike, by contrast, found it effective to replace all online news with an older technology, the radio. He discovered that putting on NPR in the background while working on manual tasks kept him sufficiently up to speed and saved him from many of the worst features of internet news. Ramel also embraced an older technology. Instead of checking social media feeds to stay up to date, he now has a newspaper delivered to his NYU dorm. Perhaps predictably, many of the participants in my mass declutter experiment ended up abandoning the social media services that used to take up so much of their time. These services have a way of entering your life through cultural pressure and vague value propositions, so they tend not to hold up well when subjected to the rigor of the screen described previously. It was also common, however, for participants to reintroduce social media in a limited manner to serve specific purposes. In these cases, they were often quite rigorous in taming the services with strict operating procedures. Mariana, for example, now restricts herself to checking her remaining social media services once a week during the weekend. A sales engineer named Enrique told me that Twitter is what caused me the most harm, so he also restricted himself to checking his feed only once a week on the weekend. Ramel and Terald decided it was sufficient to take their remaining social media apps off of their phones. The extra difficulty involved in accessing these services through a web browser on their desktop computers seemed sufficient to concentrate their use to only the most important purposes. An interesting experience shared by some participants was that they eagerly returned to their optional technologies only to learn they had lost their taste for them. Here, for example, is how Kate described this experience to me. The day the declutter was over, I raced back to Facebook, to my old blogs, to Discord, gleeful and ready to dive back in. And then, after about 30 minutes of aimless browsing, I kind of looked up and thought, why am I doing this? This is boring? This isn't bringing me any kind of happiness. It took a declutter for me to notice that these technologies aren't actually adding anything to my life. She hasn't used those services since. Several participants discovered that eliminating the point-and-click relationship maintenance enabled by social media requires that you introduce alternative systems for connecting with your friends. A digital advertiser named Ilona, for example, set up a regular schedule for calling and texting her friends, which supported her most serious relationships at the cost of some of the more lightweight touches many have come to expect. In the end, I just accepted the fact that I would miss some events in their lives, but that this was worthwhile for the mental energy it would save me to not be on social media. Other participants settled on unusual operating procedures during the reintroduction process. Abby, a Londoner who works in the travel industry, removed the web browser from her phone, a non-trivial hack. "I figured I didn't need to know the answer to everything instantly," she told me. She then bought an old-fashioned notebook to jot down ideas when she's bored on the tube. Caleb set a curfew for his phone. He can't use it between the hours of 9 p.m. and 7 a.m., while a computer engineer named Ron gives himself a quota of only 2 websites he's allowed to regularly check, a big improvement over the 40 or more sites he used to cycle through. Rebecca transformed her daily experience by buying a watch. This might sound trivial to older listeners, but to a 19-year-old like Rebecca, this was an intentional act. "I estimate that around 75% of the time I got sucked down a rabbit hole of unproductivity was due to me checking my phone for the time." To summarize the main points about this step, your month-long break from optional technologies resets your digital life. You can now rebuild it from scratch in a much more intentional and minimalist manner. To do so, apply a 3-step technology screen to each optional technology you're thinking about reintroducing. This process will help you cultivate a digital life in which new technologies serve your deeply held values as opposed to subverting them without your permission. It is in this careful reintroduction that you make the intentional decisions that will define you as a digital minimalist. Part 2. Practices. 4. Spend time alone. When solitude saved the nation. When you drive north from the National Mall in Washington, D.C. on 7th Street, your route begins among condo buildings and monumental stone architecture. After around 2 miles, it shifts to the brick row houses and crowded restaurants of the close-in city neighborhoods, Shaw, then Columbia Heights, and then, finally, Petworth. Many of the commuters who follow this route up through Petworth don't realize that just a couple of blocks to the east, hidden behind a concrete perimeter wall and a gatehouse manned by a soldier, is a pocket of calm. The property is the Armed Forces Retirement Home, which has been located here in the heights overlooking downtown D.C. since 1851, when, under pressure from Congress, the federal government bought the land from banker George Riggs to build a home for disabled veterans of the country's recent wars. In the 19th century, the Soldiers' Home, as it was originally called, was surrounded by countryside. Today, the city sprawls well beyond the property, but when you pull through its main gates, as I did on an unseasonably warm fall afternoon while researching this book, its ability to provide a sense of escape remained intact. As I drove onto the grounds, the noise of the city diminished. There were green lawns, old trees, chirping birds, and the laughter of children from a nearby charter school playing on a playground. As I turned into a visitor's parking lot, I caught my first glimpse of what I had come to see, the sprawling 35-room Gothic Revival-style cottage originally built by George Riggs and recently restored to recapture how it would have appeared in the 1860s. This cottage is now a National Historic Site because it once played host to a famous visitor. During each summer and early fall of 1862, 1863, and 1864, President Abraham Lincoln resided there, commuting back and forth to the White House on horseback. But this site is more than just a place where an important president stayed. A growing amount of research suggests that the time and space for quiet reflection the cottage enabled may have played a key role in helping Lincoln make sense of the traumas of the Civil War and tackle the hard decisions he faced. It was this idea that something as simple as silence might have shaped our country's history that brought me to Lincoln's cottage that fall afternoon to find out more. To understand Lincoln's drive to escape the White House, you must imagine what life was like for this untested one-term congressman thrust unexpectedly into command during our country's most trying period to date. Immediately after Lincoln's inauguration, the day he gave his heady "Better Angels of Our Nature" address and attempted to convince the splintering Union that it could endure, Lincoln was launched into a whirlwind of duty and distraction. "This president had absolutely no honeymoon," writes historian William Lee Miller. "He had no calm first days in which he could settle into the presidential office and think his way toward what he wanted to do by careful steps. Instead, as Miller colorfully puts it, he was slapped in the face the first business minute of his presidency by the necessity of decision." Miller is not exaggerating. As Lincoln later conveyed to his friend, Senator Orville Browning, "The first thing that was handed to me after I entered this room when I came from the inauguration was the letter from Major Anderson, saying that their provisions would be exhausted." Major Anderson was the commander of the besieged Fort Sumter in Charleston, the fulcrum on which the threat of a looming civil war then rested. The decision on whether to evacuate or defend Sumter was just the first of an avalanche of similar crises that Lincoln faced daily as the executive of a union sliding toward dissolution. The gravity of these times was not enough to free Lincoln from other less weighty obligations that relentlessly claimed most of the remaining scraps of his schedule. "Virtually from Lincoln's first day in office," writes Lincoln scholar Harold Holzer, "a crush of visitors besieged the White House stairways and corridors, climbed through windows at levees, and camped outside Lincoln's office door. These visitors arrived to petition for jobs or other personal favors, and included friends and more than a few relatives of Mary Lincoln. The White House Historical Association preserves an engraving in their archives, originally published in a newspaper a month after Lincoln's inauguration, that succinctly captures this reality. It shows a crowd of 24 top-hatted men milling right outside the doors to the room where Lincoln was meeting with his cabinet. They were there, the caption explains, to aggressively seek employment as soon as the president emerged." Even though Lincoln eventually attempted to better organize these visitors, making them take turns As if waiting to be shaved at a barber's shop, Lincoln joked. Dealing with the public remained, as Holzer summarizes, the biggest drain on the president's time and energy. Against this backdrop of bustle, Lincoln's decision to spend almost half the year escaping the White House, setting out each night to make the long horseback commute to the quiet cottage at the soldiers' home, makes sense. The cottage provided Lincoln something we now see would have been almost impossible to obtain in the White House: time and space to think. Mary and the president's son Tad lived with Lincoln at the cottage. Their older son Robert was away at college, but they frequently traveled, so the president often had the sprawling house to himself. To be sure, Lincoln was never literally by himself at the soldiers' home. In addition to his household staff, two companies of the 150th Pennsylvania Volunteers were camped on the lawn to provide protection. But what made his time at the cottage special was the lack of people demanding his attention. Even when he wasn't technically alone, Lincoln was able to be alone with his thoughts. We know that Lincoln took advantage of this quiet to think because many accounts of people coming to visit Lincoln at the cottage specifically mention that their arrival interrupted his solitude. A letter written by a Treasury employee named John French, for example, describes the following scene when he arrived unannounced with his friend Colonel Scott during the early darkness of a summer evening. The servant who answered the bell led the way into the little parlor where, in the gloaming, entirely alone, sat Mr. Lincoln, having thrown off coat and shoes, and with a large palm-leaf fan in his hand. He reposed in a broad chair, one leg hanging over its arm. He seemed to be in deep thought. Lincoln's commute through the countryside between the Capitol and his cottage also provided time for him to think. We know Lincoln valued this source of solitude, as he would occasionally sneak out to begin his ride back to the Capitol without the cavalry company assigned to protect him. This was not a decision made lightly, as the military had previously uncovered a Confederate plot to assassinate Lincoln on this route, and the president was shot at least one occasion during the ride. This time to reflect likely refined Lincoln's responses to key events during his presidency. Folklore, for example, describes Lincoln scribbling the Gettysburg Address on the train ride to deliver his famed speech. This was not, however, Lincoln's usual process. He typically worked on drafts for weeks leading up to important events. As Aaron Carlson Mast, the executive director of the nonprofit that oversees the cottage, explained to me during my visit, during the weeks leading up to the Gettysburg Address, Lincoln was here at the cottage, often walking alone at night in the military cemetery. He didn't keep a diary, so we don't know his innermost thoughts, but we know he was here, encountering the human cost of war, right before he wrote those memorable lines. The cottage also provided the setting where Lincoln wrestled with the Emancipation Proclamation. Both the necessity to free Southern slaves and the form that this emancipation should take were complicated questions that vexed the Lincoln administration, especially at a time when they were terrified of losing the border slave states to the Confederacy. Lincoln invited visitors like Senator Orville Browning to the cottage to discuss the relevant issues. The president would also famously record his ideas on scraps of paper that he would sometimes store in the lining of his top hat as he wandered the grounds. Lincoln eventually wrote the initial drafts of the proclamation at the cottage. When I toured the house, I saw the desk where Lincoln first penned these important words. It sits in his high-ceilinged bedroom between two tall windows that overlook the back lawn. When Lincoln sat there, he would have seen the tents of the Union soldiers camped on the grass of the lawn and, a few miles beyond, the dome of the nation's capital, which at the time, like the country, was still under construction. The desk I saw in Lincoln's cottage is a replica, as the original was moved to the Lincoln bedroom of the White House. This is ironic because almost certainly Lincoln would have struggled much more with this historical task if he had been forced to grapple with it amid the bustle and distraction of his official residence. Lincoln's time alone with his thoughts played a crucial role in his ability to navigate a demanding wartime presidency. We can therefore say, with only mild hyperbole, that in a certain sense, solitude helped save the nation. The goal of this chapter is to argue that the benefits Lincoln received from his time alone extend beyond historical figures or those similarly faced with major decisions. Everyone benefits from regular doses of solitude, and, equally important, anyone who avoids this state for an extended period of time will, like Lincoln during his early months in the White House, suffer. I hope to convince you that, regardless of how you decide to shape your digital ecosystem, you should follow Lincoln's example and give your brain the regular doses of quiet it requires to support a monumental life. The value of solitude. Before we can usefully discuss solitude, we need to better understand what we mean by this term. To aid us in this effort, we can turn toward an unlikely pair of guides, Raymond Kethledge and Michael Irwin. Kethledge is a respected judge serving on the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, and Irwin is a former Army officer who served in both Iraq and Afghanistan. The name Raymond Kethledge may sound familiar, as in the summer of 2018, he was reported to be one of four names on President Donald Trump's shortlist for Supreme Court nominee to replace Anthony Kennedy. Kethledge and Irwin first met in 2009, when Irwin was stationed in Ann Arbor to study toward a graduate degree. Though Kethledge and Irwin were separated in both age and life experiences, it didn't take long for them to recognize a shared interest in the topic of solitude. Kethledge, it turns out, relies on long periods alone with his thoughts to write his famously sharp legal opinions, often working at a simple pine desk in a barely renovated barn with no internet connection. "I get an extra 20 IQ points from being in that office," he explains. Irwin, for his part, used long runs alongside the cornfields of Michigan to work through the difficult emotions he faced on first returning from combat, joking that, "Running is cheaper than therapy." Soon after their initial meeting, Kethledge and Irwin decided to co-write a book on the topic of solitude. It took them 7 years, but their efforts culminated in the 2017 release of Lead Yourself First. The book summarizes, with the tight logic you expect from a federal judge and a former military officer, the author's case for the importance of being alone with your thoughts. Before outlining their case, however, the authors start with what is arguably one of their most valuable contributions, a precise definition of solitude. Many people mistakenly associate this term with physical separation, requiring, perhaps, that you hike to a remote cabin miles from another human being. This flawed definition introduces a standard of isolation that can be impractical for most to satisfy on any sort of regular basis. As Kethledge and Irwin explain, however, solitude is about what's happening in your brain, not the environment around you. Accordingly, they define it to be a subjective state in which your mind is free from input from other minds. You can enjoy solitude in a crowded coffee shop, on a subway car, or, as President Lincoln discovered at his cottage, while sharing your lawn with two companies of Union soldiers, so long as your mind is left to grapple only with its own thoughts. On the other hand, solitude can be banished in even the quietest setting if you allow input from other minds to intrude. In addition to direct conversation with another person, these inputs can also take the form of reading a book, listening to a podcast, watching TV, or performing just about any activity that might draw your attention to a smartphone screen. Solitude requires you to move past reacting to information created by other people and focus instead on your own thoughts and experiences, wherever you happen to be. Why is solitude valuable? Kethledge and Irwin detail many benefits, most of which concern the insight and emotional balance that comes from unhurried self-reflection. Of the many case studies they present, one that resonated particularly strongly concerned Martin Luther King, Jr. They note that King's involvement in the Montgomery bus boycott started haphazardly. King happened to be the charismatic and well-educated new minister in town when the local chapter of the NAACP decided to take a stand against bus segregation policies. King's subsequent nomination to be the leader of the newly formed Montgomery Improvement Association which occurred in a church meeting in late 1955, caught King off guard. He agreed only reluctantly, saying, "Well, if you think I can render some service, I will." As the boycott dragged on, pressures increased both on King's leadership and his personal safety. These pressures were particularly intense, given the unintentional manner in which King had become involved in the boycott. These forces culminated on January 27, 1956, the night after King was released from his first stint in jail, where he had been locked up as part of an organized campaign of police harassment. King returned home after his wife and young daughter had gone to sleep and realized that the time had come for him to clarify what he was about. Sitting alone with his thoughts, holding a cup of coffee at his kitchen table, King prayed and reflected. He embraced the solitude needed to make sense of the demands placed upon him, and in this space he found the answer that would provide him the courage needed for what was ahead. And it seemed at that moment that I could hear an inner voice saying to me, "Martin Luther, stand up for righteousness. Stand up for justice. Stand up for truth." Biographer David Garrow later described this event as the most important night of King's life. Irwin and Kethledge are not, of course, the first commentators to notice the importance of solitude. Its benefits have been explored since at least the early years of the Enlightenment. Solitude has been studied in various guises in a religious context back through antiquity, where it has long served important purposes in helping connect to the divine and sharpen moral intuition. I pick up this thread relatively late in the history of civilization, mainly for concision's sake. All of humanity's problems stem from man's inability to sit quietly in a room alone, Blaise Pascal famously wrote in the late 17th century. Half a century later, and an ocean away, Benjamin Franklin took up the subject in his journal. "I have read abundance of fine things on the subject of solitude. I acknowledge solitude an agreeable refreshment to a busy mind." It's worth noting that Franklin followed up this note in praise of solitude by cautioning that spending too much time alone is not good for a sociable being. His exact quip: "Were these thinking people who value solitude obliged to always be alone, I am apt to think they would quickly find their very being insupportable to them." The Academy was late to recognize the importance of time alone with your own thoughts. In 1988, the noted English psychiatrist Anthony Storr helped correct this omission with his seminal book, Solitude: A Return to the Self. As Storr noted, by the 1980s, psychoanalysis had become obsessed with the importance of intimate personal relationships, identifying them as the most important source of human happiness. But Storr's study of history didn't seem to support this hypothesis. He opens his 1988 book with the following quote from Edward Gibbon: "Conversation enriches the understanding, but solitude is the school of genius." He then boldly writes, "Gibbon is surely right." Edward Gibbon lived a solitary life, but not only did he produce wildly influential work, he also seemed perfectly happy. Storr notes that the need to spend a great deal of time alone was common among the majority of poets, novelists, and composers. He lists Descartes, Newton, Locke, Pascal, Spinoza, Kant, Leibniz, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, Kierkegaard, and Wittgenstein as examples of men who never had families or fostered close personal ties, yet still managed to lead remarkable lives. Storr's conclusion is that we are wrong to consider intimate interaction as the sine qua non of human thriving. Solitude can be just as important for both happiness and productivity. It's hard to ignore the fact that the entirety of Storr's list of remarkable lives, as well as many of the other historical examples just cited, focus on men. As Virginia Woolf argued in her 1929 feminist manifesto, A Room of One's Own, this imbalance should not come as a surprise. Woolf would agree with Storr that solitude is a prerequisite for original and creative thought, but she would add that women have been systematically denied both the literal and figurative room of their own in which to cultivate this state. To Woolf, in other words, solitude is not a pleasant diversion, but instead a form of liberation from the cognitive oppression that results in its absence. In Wolff's time, women were denied this liberation by a patriarchal society. In our time, this oppression is increasingly self-inflicted by our preference for the distraction of the digital screen. This is the theme taken up by a Canadian social critic named Michael Harris in his 2017 book, also titled Solitude. Harris is concerned that new technologies help create a culture that undermines time alone with your thoughts, noting that it matters enormously when that resource is under attack. His survey of the relevant literature then points to three crucial benefits provided by solitude: new ideas, an understanding of the self, and closeness to others. We've already discussed the first two benefits from this list, but the third is somewhat unexpected, and therefore worth briefly unpacking, especially considering how relevant it will become when we later explore solitude's tension with the benefits of connectivity. Harris argues, perhaps counterintuitively, that the ability to be alone is anything but a rejection of close bonds, and can instead affirm them. Calmly experiencing separation, he argues, builds your appreciation for interpersonal connections when they do occur. Harris is not the first to note this connection. The poet and essayist May Sarton explored the strangeness of this point in a 1972 diary entry, writing, "I am here alone for the first time in weeks, to take up my real life again at last. That is what is strange, that friends, even passionate love, are not my real life, unless there is time alone in which to explore and to discover what is happening or has happened. Without the interruptions, nourishing and maddening, this life would become arid. Yet I taste it fully only when I am alone." Wendell Berry summarized this point more succinctly when he wrote, "We enter solitude, in which also we lose loneliness." Examples similar to those just given are voluminous and point to a clear conclusion. Regular doses of solitude, mixed in with our default mode of sociality, are necessary to flourish as a human being. It's more urgent now than ever that we recognize this fact because, as I'll argue next, for the first time in human history, solitude is starting to fade away altogether. Solitude deprivation. The concern that modernity is at odds with solitude is not new. Writing in the 1980s, Anthony Storr complained that contemporary Western culture makes the peace of solitude difficult to attain. He pointed to Muzak and the recent invention of the car telephone as the latest evidence of this encroachment of noise into all parts of our lives. Over 100 years earlier, Thoreau demonstrated a similar concern, famously writing in Walden that "we are in great haste to construct a magnetic telegraph from Maine to Texas, but Maine and Texas, it may be, have nothing important to communicate." The question before us, then, is whether our current moment offers a new threat to solitude that is somehow more pressing than those that commentators have bemoaned for decades. I argue that the answer is a definitive yes. To understand my concern, the right place to start is the iPod revolution that occurred in the first years of the 21st century. We had portable music before the iPod, most commonly in the form of the Sony Walkman and Discman and their competitors. But these devices played only a restricted role in most people's lives, something you use to entertain yourself while exercising or in the back seat of a car on a long family road trip. If you stood on a busy city street corner in the early 1990s, you would not see too many people sporting black foam Sony earphones on their way to work. By the early 2000s, however, if you stood on that same street corner, white earbuds would be near ubiquitous. The iPod succeeded not just by selling lots of units, but also by changing the culture surrounding portable music. It became common, especially among younger generations, to allow your iPod to provide a musical backdrop to your entire day, putting the earbuds in as you walk out the door and taking them off only when you couldn't avoid having to talk to another human. To put this in context, previous technologies that threatened solitude, from Thoreau's telegraph to Storr's car phone, introduced new ways to occasionally interrupt time alone with your thoughts, whereas the iPod provided for the first time the ability to be continuously distracted from your own mind. The farmer in Thoreau's time might leave the quiet fireside to walk to town and check the evening telegraph dispatches, fragmenting a moment of solitude. But there was no way that this technology could offer continuous distraction to this same farmer as he went about his day. The iPod was pushing us toward a newly alienated phase in our relationship with our own minds. This transformation started by the iPod, however, didn't reach its full potential until the release of its successor, the iPhone, or more generally, the spread of modern internet-connected smartphones in the second decade of the 21st century. Even though iPods became ubiquitous, there were still moments in which it was either too much trouble to slip in the earbuds, think waiting to be called into a meeting, or it might be socially awkward to do so, think sitting bored during a slow hymn at a church service. The smartphone provided a new technique to banish these remaining slivers of solitude, the quick glance. At the slightest hint of boredom, you can now surreptitiously glance at any number of apps or mobile-adapted websites that have been optimized to provide you an immediate and satisfying dose of input from other minds. It's now possible to completely banish solitude from your life. Thoreau and Storr worried about people enjoying less solitude. We must now wonder if people might forget this state of being altogether. Part of what complicates discussions of waning solitude in the smartphone age is that it's easy to underestimate the severity of this phenomenon. While many people admit that they use their phones more than they probably should, they often don't realize the full magnitude of this technology's impact. The NYU professor Adam Alter, whom I introduced earlier in this book, details a typical story of such underestimation in Irresistible. While researching his book, Alter decided to measure his own smartphone use. To do so, he downloaded an app called Moment, which tracks how often and how long you look at your screen each day. Before activating the app, Alter estimated that he probably checks his phone around 10 times a day, for a total of about an hour of screen time. A month later, Moment provided Alter the truth. On average, he was picking up his phone 40 times per day, and spending around a total of 3 hours looking at his screen. Surprised, Alter contacted Kevin Holesh, the app developer behind Moment. As Holesh revealed, Alter is not an outlier. In fact, he's remarkably typical. The average Moment user spends right around 3 hours a day looking at their smartphone screen, with only 12% spending less than an hour. The average Moment user picks up their phone 39 times a day. As Holesh reminds Alter, these numbers probably skew low, as the people who download an app like Moment are people who are already careful about their phone use. There are millions of smartphone users who are oblivious or just don't care enough to track their usage, Alter concludes. There's a reasonable chance they're spending even more than 3 hours on their phone each day. The smartphone usage numbers just cited only count the time spent looking at your screen. When you add in time spent listening to music, audiobooks, and podcasts, none of which are measured by the Moment app, it should become more clear how effective people have become in banishing moments of solitude from their daily experience. To simplify our discussion, let's give this trend its own name. Solitude deprivation. A state in which you spend close to zero time alone with your own thoughts and free from input from other minds. As recently as the 1990s, solitude deprivation was difficult to achieve. There were just too many situations in everyday life that forced you to be alone with your thoughts, whether you wanted to or not. Waiting in line, crammed into a crowded subway car, walking down the street, working on your yard. Today, as I've just argued, it's become widespread. The key question, of course, is whether the spread of solitude deprivation should concern us. Tackled abstractly, the answer is not immediately obvious. The idea of being alone can seem unappealing, and we've been sold, over the past two decades, the idea that more connectivity is better than less. Surrounding the announcement of his company's 2012 IPO, for example, Mark Zuckerberg triumphantly wrote, "Facebook was built to accomplish a social mission, to make the world more open and connected." This obsession with connection is clearly overly optimistic, and it's easy to make light of its grandiose ambition. But when solitude deprivation is put into the context of the ideas discussed earlier in this chapter, this prioritization of communication over reflection becomes a source of serious concern. For one thing, when you avoid solitude, you miss out on the positive things it brings you. The ability to clarify hard problems, to regulate your emotions, to build moral courage, and to strengthen relationships. If you suffer from chronic solitude deprivation, therefore, the quality of your life degrades. Eliminating solitude also introduces new negative repercussions that we are only now beginning to understand. A good way to investigate a behavior's effect is to study a population that pushes the behavior to an extreme. When it comes to constant connectivity, these extremes are readily apparent among young people born after 1995. The first group to enter their preteen years with access to smartphones, tablets, and persistent internet connectivity. As most parents or educators of this generation will attest, their device use is constant. The term constant is not hyperbole. A 2015 study by Common Sense Media found that teenagers were consuming media, including text messaging and social networks, 9 hours per day on average. This group, therefore, can play the role of a cognitive canary in the coal mine. If persistent solitude deprivation causes problems, we should see them show up here first. And this is exactly what we find. My first indication that this hyper-connected generation was suffering came a few years before I started writing this book. I was chatting with the head of mental health services at a well-known university where I had been invited to speak. This administrator told me that she had begun seeing major shifts in student mental health. Until recently, the mental health center on campus had seen the same mix of teenage issues that have been common for decades: homesickness, eating disorders, some depression, and the occasional case of OCD. Then, everything changed. Seemingly overnight, the number of students seeking mental health counseling massively expanded, and the standard mix of teenage issues was dominated by something that used to be relatively rare: anxiety. She told me that everyone seemed to suddenly be suffering from anxiety or anxiety-related disorders. When I asked her what she thought caused the change, she answered without hesitation that it probably had something to do with smartphones. The sudden rise in anxiety-related problems coincided with the first incoming classes of students that were raised on smartphones and social media. She noticed that these new students were constantly and frantically processing and sending messages. It seemed clear that the persistent communication was somehow messing with the students' brain chemistry. A few years later, this administrator's hunch was validated by San Diego State University psychology professor Jean Twenge, who is one of the world's foremost experts on generational differences in American youth. As Twenge notes in a September 2017 article for The Atlantic, she has been studying these trends for over 25 years, and they almost always appear and grow gradually. But starting around 2012, she noticed a shift in measurements of teenager emotional states that was anything but gradual. The gentle slopes of the line graphs, charting how behavioral traits change with birth year, became steep mountains and sheer cliffs, and many of the distinctive characteristics of the millennial generation began to disappear. In all my analyses of generational data, some reaching back to the 1930s, I had never seen anything like it. Young people born between 1995 and 2012, a group Twenge calls iGen, exhibited remarkable differences as compared to the millennials that preceded them. One of the biggest and most troubling changes was iGen's psychological health. "Rates of teen depression and suicide have skyrocketed," Twenge writes, with much of this seemingly due to a massive increase in anxiety disorders. It's not an exaggeration to describe iGen as being on the brink of the worst mental health crisis in decades. What instigated these changes? Twenge agrees with the intuition of the university mental health administrator when she notes that these shifts in mental health correspond exactly to the moment when American smartphone ownership became ubiquitous. The defining trait of iGen, she explains, is that they grew up with iPhones and social media and don't remember a time before constant access to the internet. They're paying a price for this distinction with their mental health. Much of this deterioration can be traced to their phones, Twenge concludes. When journalist Benoit Denizet Lewis investigated this teen anxiety epidemic in the New York Times magazine, he also discovered that the smartphone kept emerging as a persistent signal among the noise of plausible hypotheses. Anxious kids certainly existed before Instagram, he writes, but many of the parents I spoke to worried that their kids' digital habits, round-the-clock responding to texts, posting to social media, obsessively following the filtered exploits of peers, were partly to blame for their children's struggles. Denizet Lewis assumed that the teenagers themselves would dismiss this theory as standard parental grumbling, but this is not what happened. To my surprise, anxious teenagers tended to agree. A college student he interviewed at a residential anxiety treatment center put it well. Social media is a tool, but it's become this thing that we can't live without that's making us crazy. As part of his reporting, Denizet Lewis interviewed Jean Twenge, who made it clear that she didn't set out to implicate the smartphone. It seemed like too easy an explanation for negative mental health outcomes in teens. But it ended up the only explanation that fit the timing. Lots of potential culprits, from stressful current events to increased academic pressure, existed before the spike in anxiety that begins around 2011. The only factor that dramatically increased right around the same time as teenage anxiety was the number of young people owning their own smartphones. The use of social media and smartphones look culpable for the increase in teen mental health issues, she told Denizet Lewis. It's enough for an arrest, and as we get more data, it might be enough for a conviction. To emphasize the urgency of this investigation, Twenge titled her article in The Atlantic with a blunt question. Have smartphones destroyed a generation? Returning to our canary in the coal mine analogy, the plight of iGen provides a strong warning about the danger of solitude deprivation. When an entire cohort unintentionally eliminated time alone with their thoughts from their lives, their mental health suffered dramatically. On reflection, this makes sense. These teenagers have lost the ability to process and make sense of their emotions, or to reflect on who they are and what really matters, or to build strong relationships, or even to just allow their brains time to power down their critical social circuits, which are not meant to be used constantly, and to redirect that energy to other important cognitive housekeeping tasks. We shouldn't be surprised that these absences lead to malfunctions. Most adults stop short of the constant connectivity practiced by members of iGen, but if you extrapolate these effects to the somewhat milder forms of solitude deprivation that have become common among many different age groups, the results are still worrisome. As I've learned by interacting with my readers, many have come to accept a background hum of low-grade anxiety that permeates their daily lives. When looking for explanations, they might turn to the latest crisis, be it the recession of 2009 or the contentious election of 2016, or chalk it up to a normal reaction to the stresses of adulthood. But once you begin studying the positive benefits of time alone with your thoughts, and encounter the distressing effects that appear in populations that eliminate this altogether, a simpler explanation emerges. We need solitude to thrive as human beings, and in recent years, without even realizing it, we've been systematically reducing this crucial ingredient from our lives. Simply put, humans are not wired to be constantly wired. The Connected Cabin. Assuming you accept my premise that solitude is necessary to thrive as a human being, the natural follow-up question is, how can you find enough of this solitude in the hyper-connected 21st century? To answer it, we can draw an unexpected insight from Thoreau's cabin at Walden Pond.